This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. There are all kinds of sayings about timing. How many times have you heard that it's everything? But what exactly is timing, and are there ways to improve it or build upon it as a skill? In his latest book, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, Daniel Pink makes the case that timing is a science. Drawing on research from psychology, biology, and economics, Pink reveals how best to live, work, and succeed, from using the hidden patterns of the day to build the ideal schedule, to turning a stumbling beginning into a fresh start. I recently spoke with him about the discoveries he made about timing while he was researching his book. Daniel, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
A lot of people view timing as an art or something that's based on gut feeling. You say it's a science, and why do you say it's a science?
Well, because if you look at a whole range of different academic fields, from economics to social psychology to anesthesiology to chronobiology, what you find is you have scholars asking in very, very different domains very similar questions. How does time of day affect what we do and how we do it? How do beginnings affect our behavior? How do midpoints affect our behavior? How do endings affect our behavior? And if you go into this research, what I've tried to do is you can make systematically better when decisions in our own life based on the evidence, rather than making when decisions, as I usually did, based on guessing or intuition.
So some of that research revolved around 500 million tweets. What do those half a billion tweets tell us about the ideal work schedule?
Oh, man, that's a really interesting piece of research out of Cornell. And what it found was that, what it did is there's a program out there that can take text, and the text can evaluate whether words have positive words or negative words. And so they took 500 million tweets, put the text into this program, and said, how does people's mood change over the course of a day? And what these researchers found is that there was a systematic pattern of mood over the course of a day. There was a peak, a trough, and a rebound. In the morning, people had generally positive mood. In the afternoon, there was a trough. And in the late afternoon and early evening, there was a recovery. And that's just one piece here that other researchers, using other kinds of methods, have come to the same kind of conclusion, that there's this hidden pattern of the day. It affects our mood, and it definitely affects our performance at work.
So why should you never have surgery or let your kids take a standardized test, say, in the afternoon? Why is that a bad timing?
Yeah. Listen, I mean, if you look at, again, if this is like, you know, just we look at the evidence, all right? So we think about our schools, and we say, okay, schools are very deliberate about what we teach and who's going to teach it and how we're going to teach it. But when we teach stuff, when kids do stuff, we don't think about it that much. So there's research out of Denmark led by Francesca Gino at Harvard who looked at 2 million Danish standardized test scores. In Denmark, students take these tests on computers rather than on, you know, bubble forms with number 2 pencils. But the typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take it at the same time. So they randomly assign students when to take the test, and it turns out the students who take tests in the afternoon score systematically lower than students who take it in the morning. It's akin to missing 2 weeks of school. Or healthcare. We schedule our doctor's appointments, and we look carefully, okay, who's the best doctor for this, and, you know, who's covered by my insurance policy, and what questions do I need to ask her when I go in for an appointment? And yet when we think about the timing of the appointment, it doesn't really matter. We want something that's convenient. But instead, it matters. So if you look at healthcare, you find that, for instance, anesthesia errors, 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. Hand washing inside of hospitals deteriorates significantly in the afternoons versus the morning. Doctors much more likely to prescribe unnecessary antibiotics in the afternoon than in the morning. You look at colonoscopies. Endoscopists find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as we do in morning exams, even for the same population. So, again, all times of day are not created equal. We perform differently at different times of day, and if we simply take that into account in how we navigate our lives, we're going to be happier, healthier, and more productive.
And I take it, Daniel, the same thing applies to if you have to appear before a judge, you probably want to appear before the judge in the morning.
Oh my Lord, there's some sort of alarming research on that out of Israel on parole board showing that judges are more likely to grant parole early in the day and immediately after a break. And the difference between after they have a break and the difference between that sequence is enormous. So if you go to a judge for parole in this study immediately before that judge is about to have a break, you have very little chance of getting parole. But if you happen to be the person coming after she comes back from a break, then you have actually a really good chance of getting parole. And this is alarming, you know, because we think that judges are meting out justice based on the facts and the law, rational deliberation and morality, when in fact judges in those black robes are subject to these daily patterns as any of us.
You talk about breaks. What is the importance of breaks? I mean, a lot of people view those as, you know, slackers take breaks, people who are lazy take breaks, maybe. But you say they're actually quite good for productivity.
Oh yeah, and listen, I was one of the people who said that until not very long ago, and I had it totally wrong. You're sort of, Mark, channeling the old me. I used to think that amateurs took breaks and professionals didn't. And it's the exact opposite. Professionals take breaks, amateurs don't. What we know about breaks, in my view, is that breaks are where, science of breaks is where the science of sleep was not too long ago. It's about to break through the surface. So that you have 15 years ago, someone who went without sleep was considered a hero, really dedicated. And now we realize, because sleep science has emerged, that person's a fool for not sleeping. The same thing is true with breaks. We have to think of breaks as not a deviation from our performance, but as part of performance. And you see this in a whole range of different fields, that if you give people breaks, so for instance, let's go back to those nurses in the hospital who weren't washing their hands. The remedy for that was giving nurses more breaks and giving them certain kinds of breaks. Go back to those Danish school children. The remedy for those sagging scores in the afternoon, give a kid a 20 to 30 minute break before they take the test, their scores go back up. And you mentioned the judges. The judges, you know, had a big effect, as I mentioned, before breaks and after breaks. So breaks we have to think of, as I said, as part of performance, not a deviation from performance, not as something that slackers do, but something that high performers do. And we also know what good breaks, replenishing breaks, have in common. We know that the best breaks are social, like with somebody else rather than solo. We know they involve movement rather than being stationary. The effects of being in nature, simply going outside, seeing a tree, is remarkable. And we also know that they should be fully detached, so leave your phone behind. And so what we're knowing about breaks is how important they are, and there's a lot of clues about how to systematically take better, more effective breaks.
And how does being involved in social activities, that social aspect that you're talking about, how does that benefit your timing?
Yeah, it's interesting. On the breaks, and this is, you know, I'm an introvert, I'm a writer, I'm an introvert, and I read this like, that's kind of weird. And then they actually tested on introverts as well. I think that when we're with other people, we are more likely to detach. So I can be in my own head on a break, and that's not as much of a detachment if I go for a walk with someone and we talk about something unrelated to anything that I'm working on. Human beings, this is not any kind of great insight, human beings are social creatures, even us introverts. And it turns out, and again, in the nurses' break, the break that allowed nurses, that replenished nurses, is actually giving them social breaks that made a huge difference in upping their hand washing.
And so there's some element of you synchronize with other people, and that's good for you.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of great research on synchronizing with other people, showing that, I mean, it's remarkable research, actually. If you look at, like, rowing teams or choirs or anything like that, that synchronizing really with other people really makes us feel good. It has huge effects physiologically, in that some kinds of syncing with other people raises our pain threshold. Choral singing is, you know, I don't want to call it a wonder drug, but it's awfully close. It raises pain thresholds, as I mentioned. It improves our immune response. And also, when we sync with other people afterwards, we're more likely to collaborate, help other people, be open to people who don't look like us.
So, Daniel, I take it that not everyone operates on the same clock. Some people are early risers, others are late night people, some people are in between. How important is it to understand what type of person you are and the variations between the way these different, I guess, they're biological clocks, how everybody's biological clock functions differently?
Yeah, it's very important to take that into account, So, there's a whole field devoted to this called chronobiology, and in fact, the last year's Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to people who are doing research in this area. What it shows is that we have different what are called chronotypes. Some of us rise early, fall asleep early. Those are, you know, we like to call those people larks. Some of us rise late, go to sleep late. We like to call those people owls. The distribution is such that we have about 15% of the population strong larks, 20% strong owls. And the rest of us in between, I like to call them third birds. And I mentioned this pattern of peak trough recovery. For larks and third birds, that's generally the order in which they go through these things. But owls are different. Owls go through it in the reverse order. They hit their analytic peak much later in the day during that late afternoon and early evening period. And the trouble is that most of the workplace is configured absolutely against owls. So, you know, we think that people who don't get into the office early are slackers. They're often not. Sometimes they're just owls. And we often don't see how much work gets done by owls when, you know, at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night.
So how do you figure out which one you are?
It's actually a fairly easy kind of – there are various assessments out there that people can find online. There's a Munich Chronotype Questionnaire, which is a set of questions that you can, that's the gold standard, really, that you can take to give you, sort of put you on the spectrum. The easiest way, though, is a very simple exercise where you think about a day when you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock, what chronobiologists call a free day. Think about what time do you usually, on your day when you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock, what time do you go to sleep? And then what time do you typically wake up? And you find the midpoint of that sleep. So for me, I will, on a free day, I will typically go to sleep at midnight and wake up at 8 in the morning. And so my midpoint of sleep would be 4 a.m. And what it shows is that if your midpoint is 3:30 or earlier, you're a lark. If it's 5:30 or later, you're an owl. And if it's in between, which is where most people are, which is where I am, you're a third bird. And so that's a very easy back-of-the-envelope way to figure out what your chronotype is.
Are more people larks, more people owls, or more people fall in that in-between category?
Many more people are in that in-between category. Owls are actually really interesting because there are actually more owls than larks. And there's some people in the distribution of the population, there's a very long tail for owls. So there's some people who are not a lot, but who are just extreme owls. I mean, you know, waking up at 1 in the afternoon, but going to sleep at 4 a.m., just not because they have a night shift, but because that's how they're wired.
I'm talking with Daniel Pink. He's the author of When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Daniel, did you look at shift workers, people who work in manufacturing, first responders, third shift versus first shift, and see any differences in the way people working in those categories perform, or do you find that people adjust to those times?
Yeah, that's a great and a very important question. There is a lot of research in chronobiology on shift workers, and what it shows, unfortunately, is that shift work is really not good for us. It's really not good for especially our physical health. And sustained shift work can have pretty negative health consequences. And so I think when we look at shift work, what we have to do is, to the extent possible, you know, minimize it, even recognizing, as you say, first responders need to be working then, certain kinds of factory shifts need to be working then. But for an individual, you know, I think that the evidence is that you don't want to do shift work, you know, for many, many, many years. The effects are not good. And, you know, because we are biological creatures, we are temporal creatures. Our biological clocks are such that in general, you know, we have this regular cycle. And so putting people out of sync with the regular cycle of our behavior and the external cues that we get from our environment, it has can have some pretty negative health consequences.
Now, some people will say, and my wife is one of these people, she'll say there's never a perfect time. So just go ahead and do whatever it is you're planning anyhow. There's no perfect time. I mean, well, I take it you would respond the opposite.
Well, I don't know if there's a perfect time, but I think we can improve our odds. So, you know, when it comes to, like, doing work, you know, for larks or third birds, do your analytic work in the morning. If you're writing a report or analyzing a financial statement, you know, make sure you do that in the morning. Don't squander your peak period answering email. You're better, you know, if you just move that right work to the right time, you're going to be better off. You know, and what we're talking here, though, I mean, your wife has a point in that we can never get perfection in our behavior, in the way that we navigate our lives, in the way that we predict the behavior of others. But we can improve our odds significantly. And so for instance, let's say you want to start a diet or an exercise regimen. At some level, it makes intuitive sense to say just start now. And there is a logic to that. But what the research shows is that we can also take advantage of what's called the fresh start effect, where there's certain days of the calendar that are better for starting things. So if you want to start a diet, yeah, okay, you can start now, but you're actually better off if you start it on a Monday rather than on a Thursday. If you start it on the 1st of a month rather than on the 14th of a month. If you start it on the day after your birthday rather than the day before your birthday. So we can improve our timing. We can never reach levels of perfection, though.
How many of those fresh start days are there altogether, Daniel?
Well, I put together a list, and I think there are about 86 of them. I think give you a chance to reboot. So some of them are socials. That is, we all share them. So you and I have the same New Year's Day. You and I have the same, you know, being Americans, have the same federal holidays. You know, when we get to the month of February, we're going to experience February 1 on the same date. But some of them are personal. So your birthday is, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing is not the same as my birthday. If you have students in the, you know, among your listeners, you know, the first day of a particular semester is going to be different from the first day of other semesters. So both social and personal fresh start dates, there are a lot of them, and we can use them to reboot, get a fresh ledger, and start again.
Speaking a little bit more about timing here, good timing versus bad timing, when you're in one of those job performance reviews, should the bad news come first or the good news come first in those?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I always gave in, you know, I mean, all of us have said, hey, I've got some good news and some bad news. And I always gave the good news first, thinking that it would cushion the blow. And what the research shows is, nope, people want the bad news first, over and over again.
So get it out of the way, in other words.
Yeah, they want to get it out of the way, and they don't want that anticipation. But more than anything, we have this, this has to do with how endings affect our behavior. We have this innate preference for endings that elevate, for rising sequences over declining sequences at the end. So based on this research, which are young researchers, Angela Legg and Kate Sweeney, have found that I've changed my ways on this, that I always give the bad news first and the good news next.
Now, people often think it's to their advantage to go first in a competitive setting. Is that the case?
Sometimes. Sometimes you can do that. If you are, there's a pretty good set of rules for this. If you are not the default choice, going first is generally helpful. So if you think about how people make decisions, many times when we make decisions, there is a default choice. So let's say that you're asking your boss for a raise. The default decision of your boss is going to say no. Let's say you're asking people, you're raising money for a charity. The default decision of the other person is going to be no. So you can get people to overcome the default more readily if you do it earlier in the day or immediately after a break. You're also better off going first when there aren't that many competitors. And if there are a lot of strong competitors, you're better off going first. On the other hand, if you are the default choice, pretty strong advantage for going later. If there are a lot of competitors, not necessarily strong ones, that going later can give you a small advantage, and actually going last can give you a huge advantage. There's some really fun research looking at not American Idol, but Idol performances, Idol competitions in other countries, showing that the singer who performed last advanced to the next round 90% of the time. You see something very similar with figure skating as well. And if you're operating in an uncertain environment, let's say they're interviewing for a job, a bunch of people coming in, but they're not sure exactly what they're looking for. Going later is more advantageous because the decision makers can use that beginning time to figure out what it is they're actually looking for.
So what are the common mistakes that people make when it comes to timing?
Well, the big mistake is they think it doesn't really matter as much as what they do or how they do it, which is flatly wrong. The other mistakes that they make are, legions of them. Not taking breaks and not taking the right kinds of breaks, doing the wrong kind of work at the wrong kind of the wrong time of day, being generally looking at these sort of temporal factors as invisible, so not recognizing that beginnings have one effect on our behavior, midpoints have other effects on our behavior, and endings have other effects. And yet much of what we do is episodic, that we have, work episodes and personal episodes, and they have beginnings, middles, and ends, and those have an effect on our behavior. So I think the big mistake is that we're not as conscious of the timing aspects of our lives. And even worse, we tend to think it's a second-order question, when in fact it's as important as deciding what we do, how we do it, and who we do it with.
Is skipping lunch a common mistake?
Yeah, it's a big mistake. Lunch is more important than we realize. There's some really interesting research.
More important than breakfast, even?
Arguably, yeah. I looked at the breakfast research, and it's like, I'm not saying breakfast isn't important, but the idea that it's the most important meal of the day, to me, doesn't seem fully backed by the science. It doesn't mean that breakfast is bad or that you shouldn't have it. I just think it's a definitive maybe. But the research on lunch, which has emerged in the last few years, is actually quite powerful. And it's showing that lunch is a very important kind of break, that if we detach, if we leave our desks, take a lunch, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, half an hour away from our desk, that can have a big subsequent effect on our performance and our creativity and our productivity. There's one piece of research out of Finland, pretty remarkable, showing that people who took lunches not only experienced less exhaustion later that day, but they actually had less exhaustion the following year if they were regular lunch takers.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, there's quite a bit of truth in the old sayings like timing is everything and time is on your side.
There is, and there's probably a reason those things have held up for so long. That timing maybe not be everything, but it's a really, really, really big thing that we need to be taking seriously. The bad news, I guess, is that we're not taking it seriously enough. The good news is that the evidence is out there, and the evidence is very accessible, and we can use it again to do a little bit better, as we were talking before. To up our odds a little bit, to make better decisions, to rearrange our schedules a little bit, to do the right things at the right time, and it can really, help us work better and live better.
Daniel, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Pink. His new book is When? The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director.